First case on our calendar, 09897, State of Ohio versus London Fisher. Ms. Cahoon.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Claire Cahoon, and on behalf of the Office of the Ohio Public Defender, I represent London Fisher in this case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
What's your time there?
Based on this court's well-established line of cases, sentences that lack the statutorily required post-release control advisement are void. The effect of those void sentences is that they are legal nullities, which means that it is as though they never existed. Because there is no sentence, there is no conviction. Without a conviction, there can be no final appealable order. An appeal from a final without a final appealable order deprives the reviewing court of subject matter jurisdiction. Without that subject matter jurisdiction, a court of appeals determination is also void.
Counsel, if we run this out to its logical extreme, and I'm not saying that your argument is illogical, it is the argument that Justice Lanzinger warned us about when we waded into this. Would that mean that one who has not been properly advised of the hold that the state is going to have on this person when they're released from prison is entitled to a new trial on the merits?
No, Your Honor. This just dovetails in with the cases this court has already issued about post-release control, which is just that sentence is void. So it's just the fact that that void sentence doesn't create a final appealable order that brings us back to having a new direct appeal.
it doesn't extend, you agree, that the conviction itself is in any way improper.
Your Honor, I agree. The finding of guilt is not undermined by the void nature of that advisement.
So what would the appeal look like then? I'm trying to understand if one has questions about the finding of guilt, when's the proper time for the appeal on that?
The only time that a criminal defendant could properly take a direct appeal would be after they have a complete conviction. And this court has stated in Whitfield recently and also in Baker that you have to have both the finding of guilt and the sentence in order for there to be a conviction. So it would only be after a criminal defendant or the state, depending on who's taking the appeal, has both of those things that they then have a final appealable order that they can go to the Court of Appeals with. And if the Court of Appeals reviews a case before we have a final appealable order because it lacks that sentence, even if there is a finding of guilt, that decision is always going to be void.
So then, counsel, in this particular case, he did take an appeal from the original finding, the
yes.
original sentence. You went through the appeal process. You now want to nullify that whole appeal process and start over with the resentencing as the fresh date for the triggering of an appeal, and then look at your options for issues regarding appeal, either ones that were not argued previously or maybe re-argue the same appellate issues. Is that correct?
You're correct. Mr. Fisher did take a direct appeal that was fully litigated, but again, that direct appeal was void, so any decision the court would have made about those issues would be invalid. Mr. Fisher's direct appeal as of right that he's taking from his BZAC resentencing mm-hmm. does encompass new issues that were not a part of his void direct appeal. They're substantive trial issues that should be reviewed and determined by the Court of Appeals that were not initially presented.
So, counsel, wouldn't you suggest that your answer to Justice Pfeiffer's first question might be a bit different? Because if the BZAC line of cases mean that the sentence is void, as if it never occurred, you don't have jurisdiction for the Court of Appeals to review the sentence on appeal. So anything that the court does is void because of the issue of what void means. That would mean then that if an individual comes and brings a case to the court and has the sentence voided because of a post-release control error, once the case is appealed, everything's at issue. I mean, the whole case can be appealed for the first time because now you have the jurisdiction for the Court of Appeals to look at the case.
And I may have misunderstood exactly what Justice Pfeiffer was asking me, but yes, certainly when you go back and have that first direct appeal as of right from a BZAC resentencing, you can litigate any and all trial issues that are cognizable on
and
direct appeal.
If the individual wins on appeal, it could lead to a new trial if that's what the Court of Appeals determines.
That is entirely possible, yes.
I just wanted to clarify what the logic of these cases brings us to.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you.
So this is just a do-over, a second bite of the apple. It's just everybody gets their act together and does it right and they do it over.
Well, it is a second bite of the apple in the sense that these criminal defendants have been in front of the courts of appeals before. So yes, but again, these decisions were never valid. And so it's not a second bite of the apple in the sense that these court of appeals decisions are void. And so they really should not be considered to have been original direct appeals.
And under Singleton, we're talking about all these cases before the effective date of the statute. Under Singleton, all of the cases previous, if there was any problem with the post-release control, if we follow your suggestion then, or your argument, all of these cases could be reappealed, or not reappealed, but appealed for the first time if there was post-release control error.
Well, there are some limits on that. Yes, I agree with you, but there are some limits on that. Criminal defendants who had post-release control errors in their advisements, who were sentenced after July 1st of 1996, after the new law was enacted, who are still serving a term of incarceration. As this court has already said in Simpkins that once you leave the prison, your expectation of finality crystallizes, so there's one limit there. So these would be inmates who either have not had that BZAC resentencing, they can ask the trial court for that resentencing and then take a timely direct appeal. For people who have already had that resentencing and not ever availed themselves of that direct appeal as of right, obviously under Appellate Rule 4, they're now outside of their 30 days, and it would be up to the Court of Appeals' discretionary decision whether or not to accept any of those appeals outside of that 30 days.
I want to go to the sentencing part. If you're claiming that it's void and you have to resentence, in your opinion, does that mean that all the victims have to come in again, all the evidence, the post-sentence investigation, all of that has to be reconsidered, not just the defendant brought back post-release control added and that's it?
Well, based on this court's well-established line of cases, BZAC, Simpkins, Jordan, it is a de novo sentencing. So if the state wanted to have the victims present any other information, have a PSI, things of that nature, they would have to do all of that over again, yes. And because this has been a lengthy line of cases and the courts in Ohio have been doing these post-release control resentencings, courts are already in the process of doing this. So this is not something that starts as of today. Of course, this court is well aware that Ohio trial courts are already resentencing to correct these post-release control problems.
But you're not seeking to have a resentencing, are you? You simply want the Court of Appeals to consider an assignment of error that was presented.
Correct. Absolutely right, Your Honor. Mr. Fisher already had his resentencing.
So really what we're reviewing is nothing to do with the post-release control resentencing of your client, but really rather having an appellate court rule on each assignment of error that has been presented.
Yes,
and that is a long-standing practice in Ohio, is it not?
Of reviewing all of the assignments of error that are presented?
There must be a dozen decisions at least out of this court telling appellate judges, you must rule on every assignment of error that is presented. And what happened here is nothing out of the ordinary. There were assignments of error presented, and the appellate court determined that these would not be considered by them, and they were dismissed. So why shouldn't we just send it back to the appellate court and tell them to rule on all of the assignments of error and as we do in every other case?
Well, certainly this court can and should remand this case to the Court of Appeals for a merits decision on Mr. Fisher's substantive issues.
There's really only one assignment of error, isn't there?
Yes.
The first appeal that was taken, which you're alleging is void, if we agree with you, that appeal concerns sufficiency of the evidence and manifest weight. You want the appellate court now to rule on a matter that wasn't presented in the first appeal, and it concerns the admissibility of evidence on an expert. Isn't that about a lay expert?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And that's all you want them to do?
Yes, Mr. Fisher does simply want a remand so the Court of Appeals will consider his substantive
issue. You're not claiming that you have the right to submit additional assignments of error to the appellate court, are you?
Well, what you mean on remand?
Yes.
No, I'm not suggesting that.
So all this really concerns is a remand from this court to the appellate court to have them rule on the assignment of error that they didn't consider.
Yes, that's true.
But did
counsel,
did they rule on the first? Did they say that the first two? Did you appeal the admissibility and the? Did you appeal the same things you appealed in the first case? I guess I'll start with that question.
No, Mr. Fisher's original appellate counsel raised manifest weight and sufficiency of the evidence. When I was assigned to Mr. Fisher's case, we raised both this procedural issue based on post-release control, but also this substantive issue about lay witness testimony. So while this court could and should remand his case for a substantive determination from the Court of Appeals, there would ultimately have to be some kind of a determination that that first direct appeal was void so that we can get there.
And so from anybody else who looks at this decision will simply reappeal every issue they appealed the first time if they felt it had merit and add any new issues they subsequently found to do their do-over.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that. The state and amicus argue that this will just create an enormous number of defendants who will come back for new direct appeals that have already been litigated. There are some significant limits on the number of people who would actually come back, but particularly criminal defendants who don't have any procedural problems who actually could come back for that direct appeal following their BZAC resentencing. Really, the only criminal defendants who are going to have a reasonable interest in filing that direct appeal are going to be men and women who have new issues that were not litigated in their original direct appeal. There would really be no reason for those
judging by the post-conviction that we get, they're all going to think of new issues. I can pretty well assure you of that now, can't you?
Well, that may be true, but certainly the criminal defendants who don't have new substantive issues would have no reason to think the Court of Appeals would give them a different result with the same issues.
But Ms. Calhoun, if they did appeal the same issue, the Court of Appeals could adhere to an earlier decision or just republish what it had decided, could it not?
Potentially. It's not a decided question what effect adopting this proposition of law would have on the precedential value of the earlier courts of appeals decisions.
We get that in the next case?
If you would like. So
the other question I have is, every defendant would have had to have made a record in the trial court and preserved some error to claim in the second or the subsequent appeal.
There would have to actually be an error that would be cognizable on direct appeal,
and
certainly.
And if it hadn't been preserved in the trial court, presumably it could not be presented to the appellate court, and that would be subject to dismissal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Waiver or forfeiture.
All of the regular appellate rules and procedures would still apply to this process. It's simply that now we have to decide when the clock starts. Does
what
it start?
What, in your counsel? View, is the legal effect of the first decision of the appellate court?
It has no legal effect, Your Honor. It's a legal nullity.
Okay, so your view is that the first decision of the Court of Appeals is void.
Yes, absolutely.
And as a result of that, presumably those same issues could be relitigated to the appellate court a second time.
Again, that is procedurally correct, yes, but a reasonable criminal defendant would have no expectation that they could get a different result from the same assignments.
Which is why you say this isn't going to be a floodgate at the appellate court, because they've already lost on those issues.
Yes.
Counsel, this is 2010. The sentencing occurred February 4th, 2002, correct?
The original void sentencing, yes.
So what we're saying under these cases is that on February 4th, 2002, there was a nullity. Nothing happened. It was totally void. And for 8 years, there has been no sentence, and now the defendant wants to appeal for the very first time under our cases. That's what we're saying.
And that is exactly right, yes, Your Honor.
Which seems very illogical to me. I mean, in the old way, you had 30 days to correct a sentence. Then it would be settled. Everybody would know that the case is over. What you're showing us is that all of these cases, because of this line of decisions, all of these cases are at risk if there happened to be a post-release control mistake.
Your Honor, this line of post-release control cases does mean that there could be a new direct appeal for criminal defendants that can go back for that resentencing. Yes, but again, that is limited by people who have new issues, people who can timely file within 30 days of their resentencing, and also criminal defendants who are even interested in appealing, criminal defendants who have not finished their sentence. So there are some significant limits on the number of people who will actually be affected by this rule. But yes, those people are all now entitled to their first direct appeal as of right.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, I see that your time has expired, but I want to ask you a question, so I'm sure the Chief Justice will indulge here for a moment.
Thank you.
Let's just talk about the bigger picture here, then tie on to what Justice Lansinger raised. Suppose we were in this case at a time before this court decided BZAC. So this is the first case in which we have post-release control was notice was not properly given, and we're asked what the effect of that is. And what, in your view, would the proper decision of a court be in that case if we were to wipe out all this precedent? I'm not saying we are. I'm saying assume for a moment if we were to start over or we're at the beginning. What, how would the court, should the court handle this type of a matter?
Your Honor, because post-release control is a statutorily required component of sentencing, when a sentence lacks that statutory requirement, it is void. So I would ask that the court, if we were going back to 1984 when Beasley was decided, I would ask the court to simply reissue the decision that it's already made, that these are void sentences, that expectation of finality does not crystallize until that defendant is released, and then to just take that and bring it to the logical conclusion that the dissent pointed out in Simpkins, which is then your first direct appeal was also a nullity.
Counsel, if you answered or looked at Justice Cupp's question, and the sentence had an error that wasn't appealed, after 30 days, the sentence would stand as it was, would it not?
I'm sorry, could
I mean, the idea under the pre-BZAC would have been if there was a sentencing error that was not appealed by either party, after 30 days, the sentence would stand as it was given, and that would be it. So if there was a mistake in post-release control and your client was not put on post-release control and the state had not appealed, the lack of it, after 30 days, there would be the sentence, the finality, that would be it. Your defendant or your client would not be on post-release control because it was not properly imposed, but it was not appealed.
If we did not have this line of cases?
Exactly.
That's potentially correct, but there is some intimation in State versus Perry, which I believe is decided in 67, long before this line of cases, about the difference and effect of void versus voidable. So there is still some basis for the line of cases that this court subsequently crafted in finding post-release control advisements void when they're lacking in a sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Cahoon.
Thank you.
Ms. DiMartino.
Good morning. Chief Justice Moyer, may it please the court, opposing counsel, Ms. Ingram. I'm Heaven DiMartino here on behalf of the Summit County Prosecutor's Office representing the appellee. Ms. Ingram is here on behalf of the AMICUS, the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. I would ask to reserve 5 minutes for Ms. Ingram. At this time, the appellee is asking this court to reject the appellant's proposal that if an appellate decision by a court of appeals or the Supreme Court is rendered and it was based on a trial court decision that is null and void due to a post-release defect, that decision is also null and void. We would ask the court to reject that proposition of law. We would also ask the court at this time to reconsider the BZAC line of cases.
Well, counsel, what's the rationale in your mind? What is the most compelling argument that you would make for this court not following the request of the appellant here? Is it a burden on the system? Is it more work for the prosecutor's office? What is the rationale here?
I think the most compelling rationale is that the appellant, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the judges, the courts, victims, and citizens rely on the finality of a decision from a court of appeals or the Ohio Supreme Court. It is the foundation of our judicial system. the idea of precedent and stare decisis. If these decisions are now null and void, regardless of whether someone points out that there is a PRC issue, they're simply null and void. Every case that has been decided in the state of Ohio by an appeals court or by the Ohio Supreme Court is subject to being null and void without any of us knowing it.
Now, isn't that a kind of a really monumental extrapolation of what we're doing here? We have a line of cases now, post-Bees Act. We have legislation that addresses this issue. Mm-hmm. So we've got a window of opportunity for both the state and the defendant to point out a jurisdictional flaw. And it gets sent back for a do-over, in essence. Mm-hmm. What's the problem with doing it right?
The problem is all the other cases that have been, that have come down. Let's say a case has been decided by a court of appeals. The defendant never raised the issue of post-release control. So there's a court of appeals decision, say from the 9th District. No one ever notices that post-release control error. Could have happened in the past, any time after 1996, any time before 2006. We know that pre-7-1106, those cases would still be void. So in that window, if a case was decided by the court of appeals, the trial courts are going to use that case as precedent. The court of appeals could have decided substantive law because post-release control was not an issue. There will be a line of cases that relied on that appeals case. There will be trial court judges that are relying on the law that was set out in that case. There are attorneys that are advising their clients based on the substantive law that was in that case. There are citizens that are understanding what the law is.
Do you have an example of this case that you're talking about?
I can't tell you an example of the name of a case. I did not take the time to do that. These issues are very complicated, but any case that has come before, every case is suspect to that, because if post-release control was not raised, the burden becomes on who? Every attorney in the state of Ohio to check. Look at the year a case was decided and to check, go back to the trial court and get the judgment entry, because if post-release control wasn't an issue, that journal entry is not part of the appellate record. You would have to go back to the trial court, check the judgment entry, make your own decision as to whether post-release control was given, and if it was given properly. And if it was not given properly, assume that the appellate court decision is void and every case that was decided after it is also void.
Well, then, if you're saying that there was a separate, segregated, substantive issue that was decided in an appellate case from, let's say, the 9th District, and later it was found out that there was a flaw in the post-release control sentencing provisions, and then that had to be reversed, would that not just be reversed on other grounds and the substantive law still be the substantive law?
If it's null and void, if it's a nullity, it doesn't exist at all. And what if that defendant never raises the post-release control issue? What if he had a fairly short sentence and he didn't want to raise the issue because now he would be subject to post-release control? Is that Court of Appeals decision still null and void because it was based
on... Well, under Hernandez, if he is out of... the system.
If he wasn't out, if he had a 12-month sentence, at the 11th month he realizes he has a post-release control defect, he's not likely going to bring that issue up because he could get post-release control. So it would be in his favor to not ask for that review.
Okay.
But there's a decision that's already been out on a substantive issue. He went to the Court of Appeals, he raised his substantive issues. Is that decision still null and void because he never corrected the post-release control issue? He knew it was there, let's say, but it was never raised.
Okay, but I mean, I go back to my original question. You don't have any examples of what you're talking about here.
There are probably, I couldn't give you a case name, no. But I'm sure that there are cases out there that are that way.
I was going to say, counsel, this could all be corrected easily, though, if we went back to pre-Bees Act and did not have post-release control as a super error.
Correct.
I mean, if the whole, and prosecutors in particular, the issue of post-release control, if it's mandatory post-release control, prosecutors have 30 days to look at a sentencing entry and determine if there needs to be a correction. It can be
That's
appealed,
correct.
It could be corrected immediately, and then everybody would know the finality of the sentence.
That's correct.
And is that what you were about to urge, is that we go back, overturn Bees Act, and move on from there and treat it as voidable?
Correct. I would ask.
And if we treat it as voidable, as Justice Lansinger points out, then 30 days is all anybody has.
That's correct.
And after that, if it wasn't properly imposed, there is no post-release control.
Correct.
Well, then we're not going to just limit that to post-release control errors. We're going to limit it to all sentencing errors, right?
Right, correct.
So if someone is a mandatory incarceration and the court neglects to, and the prosecutor doesn't point out the fact that, you know, judge, you just under-sentenced somebody, then that individual gets the benefit of the judicial mistake and the prosecutor's mistake. Is that the way you would like to see it?
That would be the logical extension of what I'm asking for, yes.
Mm-hmm. And who's benefited by that then? I mean, the system?
I think that ensures that the system works the way that it was supposed to, as opposed to this line of cases. I can understand that the issues that have come up on post-release control were not foreseeable, that it's a difficult concept. What has come from the line of cases, I don't think anybody could have expected. I think that if this case is not decided and a decision is narrowly tailored to this specific case, it will create much more difficulty with the post-release control
issues. And are the courts and the prosecutors inundated with these type of cases? I mean, are you overwhelmed with resentencings and do-overs?
We have seen a very large number of cases that have come back for post-release control corrections on sentencings. This is the first case I've had personally on as far as a do-over, as far as an issue like Mr. Fisher's, where he had an appeal. 6 years later, he's asking basically for a do-over, and he is asking for a second bite of the apple, despite the fact that counsel is saying he's not. If he had come back and asked, if the decision is void, he could ask for a manifest weight argument, or somebody else could come back with a manifest weight or a sufficiency argument. And the fact is after an appeal has been decided by a court of appeals and the time to appeal to the Supreme Court has expired, we retain evidence for a certain period of time. And after that, the evidence is returned or destroyed. So if we allow defendants to come back 6, 7, 8 years later, where will the evidence be? And if they've raised a manifest weight argument, there will be no evidence to present to the Court of Appeals to review. So in essence, they will get a reversal and they will get that new trial.
Counsel, I want to go back and make sure I understand that if we were here before this court had issued any decision on the effect of the trial court's failure to properly impose post-release control. So this was the first case. Your position is that this court should decide that those errors are voidable and not void. Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
That is correct.
Now that is an evolution in thinking from the prosecutors in the state's point of view, is it not? Because we have been here in case after case after case after case after case in which the state and the prosecutors have urged us to hold those sentencing errors void. I just want to make sure I'm hearing this.
I would
correctly.
Ask that the court hold that those sentencing errors are voidable because the decision of the sentencing court was based on a trial court that had personal jurisdiction as well as subject matter jurisdiction. And in those cases, the court made a mistake. It wasn't that they disregarded the law. They made a mistake. And I think that under the definitions that have been provided by the Supreme Court, that is a sentence that is subject to be corrected, which makes it voidable. And the trial court has retained jurisdiction to correct that mistake.
And since it's voidable, 30 days is all you get.
Correct.
So it's over.
Correct.
And what is the reasoning that, I mean, you have got two arguments, one it's voidable, one it's void. What about the third argument that it is simply correctable and it's neither void or voidable? Correctable at any time. Why would that not work?
I believe that until the sentence is corrected, it has to be corrected, so I believe that it's voidable, because if it is not corrected, then it could be determined to be void. So I believe that it is technically voidable as opposed to void or correctable.
It has to be one of the two. It can't be just simply correctable.
That would be my position, Your Honor.
And that's because you need finality in these decisions, correct?
We need finality, even in BZAC as well as in the Bowen case. I believe it was Bowen. The cases, I'm sorry, it was Culligan versus Medina County Court of Common Pleas. Those cases, the decision was that the matter was remanded so the trial court could, in essence, correct the sentence. Not so much that in Culligan, the court didn't say, now, defendant, you will get your appeal, but the court did say to the trial court, you need to issue a final appealable order. As well as in BZAC, the court didn't say that he would get resentenced. The court said he has fulfilled his sentence by serving the time. So we need to correct the decisions at the trial court level. Therefore, I believe that they're voidable. If there are no further questions, I would reserve my time for Ms. Ingram.
Thank you. Ms. DiMartino. Ms. Ingram.
So, Ms. Ingram, are you saying that in conjunction with the statement that your co-counsel made to Justice Kupp, is that the prosecuting attorneys, even if a judge erroneously undersentences a rapist, and ignores mandatory sentencing, and that is not caught by the prosecutor within 30 days, that's okay?
I'm not going to endorse that position on behalf of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association because
That microphone closer to your mouth? I can't hear you.
Right. I'm not going to endorse that position on behalf of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association because I don't know what the position is on that.
Well, wouldn't that have to be the result of what the Summit County prosecutor has advocated?
If it's statutorily under-sentenced, I believe that since there is, under Senate Bill 2, there is the section of the law that allows the state to appeal a sentence that's in violation of law.
30 days, but you don't catch it within 30 days.
I believe that does, however, would limit it to that. Yes, you have 30 days. So yes, I would see that argument. But what I'm here to argue to the court,
so let me stop you there because that raises for me the question, what is jurisdictional and what is not? And it seems that you are saying, at least from that statement, that there really is nothing, there are no commands by the General Assembly with respect to the duties of a trial judge that are jurisdictional, they're all voidable, or there's never a void sentence.
I don't know that that's true. I don't know that I would say that there is.
How would we draw the line? Finality of the order, of the judge's order?
Doesn't it seem, it seems to me that at some point finality takes precedence over the possibility of error, because finality will step in to stop the endless litigation of issues that have already been resolved.
That seems like the tail on the dog to me. If the General Assembly has decided as a matter of public policy, we want trial judges to do X, and the trial judge doesn't do what the General Assembly has commanded it to do, shall language. The decision, obviously, we've made, at least the majority has made since BZAC, is that trial judges have to do what, and the counsel have to simply follow the rules. And if you don't, what you have produced from not following the rules is a void act. And I guess my question is, what is so difficult to accept with that principle? Just take away all of the how many people are going to be in the system and all that. We've had those arguments before, and they usually don't amount to what they're alleged to amount to. But take as a matter of principle, how do you argue against that principle?
Argue against the principle that?
Principle that if the General Assembly has commanded the trial courts to do X, and the trial judge doesn't do X, then the counsel miss it. And it's in the example that Justice O'Connor gave you highlights it quite well. I mean, where do we go? How egregious does the error by the trial judge have to be before we say, what you have done, trial judge, is a void act?
But aren't you drawing a line that puts every mistake in a sentencing entry, mm-hmm, something that voids the sentence? Doesn't that say that any kind of error, unlike other errors that occur in the course of a trial or in sentencing, that this kind of error in an entry is always going to be void. Not ordinary error, not correctable, not voidable, but void. And if the court does that, it opens the door, like the argument that's made by Fisher, that if there's a void judgment, then the Court of Appeals jurisdiction never attached. But what I'd like the court to consider is that if the court continues with the distinction between void and voidable and placing sentencing entries like Fisher's on the void side, that it also consider the doctrine of practical finality, which puts an end to the endless relitigation on appeal of issues that have already been resolved by a court of competent jurisdiction. Now here, it may be that jurisdiction didn't attach because of an error in the sentencing entry, but London Fisher got everything he was entitled to. And make no mistake, there will be lots of people like London Fisher. And if they are entitled to a new appeal, it's not a quick appeal or a review of what was already raised. If they're entitled to appeal, it's an appeal. And they're entitled to competent counsel who reads the record, who reads the transcript, who raises every issue that was or could have been raised then, and evaluates the case.
Why is this all a negative? Why is that a negative?
Because he has had everything. First of all, because he's already had everything he's entitled to. Second, he's going to be competing for the resources of defense attorneys, because most of these are going to be indigent, prosecutors and judges who will be required.
It's a workload issue.
It's a workload issue that is not balanced by any benefit to society. If it were merely a workload issue where there were benefits, then it would be different. But it's a workload issue that, in part, but it also, I would suggest it also would corrode the respect for the law, that he is standing in the same position as someone who was convicted last week or last month, asking for the same, diverting the same resources, calling upon defense attorneys, prosecutors, and judges to direct their already scant resources to give him the chance that he's already had. And that if there were a benefit to society, it would be different. But the cost is enormous.
Was he entitled to an order of the court that enunciated his post-conviction relief rights or duties?
In his initial sentencing?
Yes. You said he's already gotten everything to which he was entitled.
And
except
now
he didn't get an order from the court that met the statutory requirement.
But now he has. And another way to look at it is that while that initial order may have been deficient, it's now been fulfilled. So that appeal that he had in the interval, it's over.
But counsel, now he has because he got resentenced. That's your argument. He didn't get what he should have gotten the first go around, but now that he's been resentenced pursuant to BZAC, he has gotten the full package. Is that what you're saying?
He has gotten what he is entitled to, which is an appellate review of every issue he raised or could have raised by a court of competent jurisdiction, even though jurisdiction may not have been properly invoked.
Okay, but also what he was entitled to was to be properly sentenced. Both the state and the defendant are entitled to a proper sentence, and he only got that pursuant to BZAC. Correct?
That's correct. He got
okay.
that pursuant to BZAC.
But you're arguing, and so too is Ms. DiMartino, is that we wipe away the whole BZAC line of cases. So if you're saying now that he got what he's entitled to pursuant to BZAC, therefore he didn't have what he was entitled to pre-BZAC, and yet we should wipe out BZAC and the line of cases that follow, I don't get the logic here.
I wouldn't say we are wiping out BZAC. I'm saying that
we're
going to limit.
Well, are you advocating for going back to pre-BZAC status of the sentencing law here in the state of Ohio?
That it was, yes. Yes, I am. But if not, I'm going to ask the court to limit the application of those cases so that when a person like Fisher, who has had a full round of appeals, is later resentenced because of a deficiency in the termination entry as regards post-release control, that while that initial termination entry may have been insufficient to confer appellate jurisdiction at the time, it is still sufficient to preclude relitigation of those issues he raised or could have raised.
But that's your fallback position, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I want to make it clear on that.
On the resentencing of Mr. Fisher.
Yes.
Pursuant to BZAC.
Yes.
When the court properly advised him of his rights and responsibilities in connection with post-release control, he had a right to appeal that to the Court of Appeals, did he not?
He had a right to appeal the resentencing.
So, in a practical application, the defendant here, Mr. Fisher, was sentenced the first time incorrectly and appealed.
Correct.
And then the matter went back and he was properly sentenced and he's entitled to a second appeal.
Our contention is that
you agree with that?
He's entitled to an appeal, but limited. But it is limited.
Okay, you want it limited only to what had gone on in connection with pre-sentencing.
With the resentencing.
With resentencing.
With resentencing, correct.
And you find it objectionable when he raises an issue with respect to testimony of a lay witness that he should be, we should not let the Court of Appeals rule on that.
That's correct, because he had the opportunity.
And you're relying, I think, on the doctrine of practical finality. That's what Judge Friendly had articulated. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
And has any state adopted that practical finality doctrine in a criminal context such as you're asking us?
I do not know. I did not see. I will tell you that the Ninth District did in a civil case.
Okay, well, Judge Friendly did in a civil case, I think.
Please?
I believe Judge Friendly did it in a civil case.
Right, that's correct.
My question to you is, does your research reveal that doctrine has ever been applied by any state or jurisdiction in a criminal context?
I have not found a case. However, I don't think that this implicates the kind of criminal, that application of this doctrine would implicate the kind of constitutional criminal protections that would justify a distinction between civil and criminal here, because he had, Fisher and those like him, had a true appeal as of right, where every issue
was from a logical
raised.
Standpoint, if Mr. Fisher has a right to appeal the second time after a proper sentencing, what extra burden? He's already got a lawyer who can appeal that for him on, as you admit, the limited resentencing issue. What extra burden is it on the judicial system to rule on an additional assignment of error or two or three or as many as it would be presented?
Oh, it would be tremendous, because think about this for an example. Let's say someone was convicted on evidence that was admissible and reliable.
Well, let's say in this instance there's one additional assignment of error. It was simply dismissed by the appellate court. Why shouldn't we send it back to them and say rule on it? What burden is that?
In this particular case, I don't know, but what I'm saying is that if you accept this proposition, we could have someone who was convicted, for example, on the basis of evidence that was at the time admissible under Ohio versus Roberts, now not admissible under Crawford. It had to be reliable to come in initially, so it's not a question of guilt. So now, if that becomes an issue, I would say if he's entitled to appeal, he's entitled to have that raised, which means that prosecutors' offices and courts are going to have to then review the entire record to see whether or not the issue was raised, and whether or not, if it was properly raised and preserved, whether or not it was reversible error, whether or not it made a difference. That was an argument that was final before, but now will be, and doesn't particularly concern guilt or innocence. It's
Thank
a technical
you.
Legal argument,
Thank
and
you.
That's just an example.
I would like to ask about the practical issues again. You had BZAC, I think, was 1996, correct?
BZAC was 96?
96. When was BZAC?
2000-something.
Right. Well, whatever. You have a case that if we say the whole appellate process is void, the defendant has the right to go back and appeal the entire trial, all the error issues. He could raise, instead of one issue, as in this case, he could raise 20 issues, but it's been 8 years. Is in fact the evidence, a lot of the evidence returned and destroyed, as the prosecutor indicated?
Yes.
That,
Yes, a lot of it will be. And it may be that when, it may be there never was an, wasn't, was an appeal. So there is no transcript. So, you know, court reporters retire. Is there a video courtroom? So there may actually be no ready record. And yes,
and if the court ends up granting a new trial, then there's no evidence left to try on because it's too old.
It's a windfall.
Or witnesses have gone or
correct.
Whatever.
It's a windfall. And it is a windfall that benefits only those like Fisher whose entries were fatally defective but cured, but who in the meantime had or had the opportunity to have a full appeal by a court of competent jurisdiction.
You've used your time, Ms. Ingram.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Boone, you used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court must draw the line at jurisdiction. The state argues practical finality, which is akin to collateral estoppel. This court held in State versus Lovejoy that in order to apply collateral estoppel, there must be a valid and final judgment.
Do you agree on the practical side that if you have an 8-year-old case that now has a new right of appeal because of a sentencing error in post-conviction relief, that if that case is overturned, the evidence may no longer be there and the witnesses may no longer be available?
That's certainly a possibility, Your Honor. So I can't disagree or with the possibility that might happen in some cases. But ultimately,
and
this
wouldn't
question...
That, wouldn't that be a good motivation for every single defendant who can benefit from the void doctrine to appeal in case they could possibly get a new trial and have a free ride now because everything's gone?
What would motivate a criminal defendant would be the desire to have their first direct appeal as of right, which because of this subject matter jurisdiction issue, they have not had. Under the new post-release control statute, the state had the obligation and the ability to appeal within 30 days these post-release control problems, and there is this BZAC line of cases because these appeals were never done. Because there is this lack of subject matter jurisdiction, these criminal defendants have been deprived of something that is very important, something that they are supposed to be guaranteed, which is the direct appeal of their entire sentence.
But you said earlier, in answer, I think, to Justice Pfeiffer's question, that the guilt finding is not affected on that. Isn't that what you argued or answered to his question?
Well, and I said in response to Justice Lansinger, I might have understood the totality of his question. There is the post-release control problems invalidates and makes that sentence void. There's still a conviction of guilt that stands,
right.
But on appeal,
so,
that criminal
so
defendant would have.
So if that finding of guilt is there, why should it be revisited?
Because it's never been properly appealed by a reviewing court with subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, it had been appealed, and only the sentence was affected. Only the post-release control issues were affected. Why should we give the defendant two appeals on the substantive guilt issues if you admit that guilt finding was not affected by the sentencing court error?
Because
why couldn't we adopt practical finality in a criminal context and say, he's had his appeal there, it's over, and we'll simply correct the sentencing error, which is the subject of the trial court default?
Because without that sentence, there is no conviction. This court held in State versus Whitfield that you have to have both. And if there's no conviction, then there's no final appealable order.
Whitfield's the problem.
Whitfield is a part of the puzzle here, but this court certainly articulated in State Auto Mutual Insurance that without a final appealable order, you can't have subject matter jurisdiction. That's also in the Ohio Revised Code.
Right.
So I would simply ask that this court not overturn 20 years worth of post-release control case law and that they adopt Mr. Fisher's proposition of law and allow him to have his guaranteed direct appeal as of right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coon. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.